Welcome to a new season of Untangled, a show from All Sides with Anna Staver and WOSU, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. Pull it apart and weave the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling redistricting in Ohio. Redistricting is the process of drawing electoral boundaries, those squiggly shapes around cities and townships that determine which lawmakers get the chance to represent which groups of people. And gerrymandering, that's drawing those lines to benefit your friends while punishing your political enemies, manipulating the boundaries to predetermine who controls the Ohio House, the state Senate, even the U.S. Congress. And these boundaries decide what kind of laws we have on abortion, education, taxes. Our districts become our destiny, which is why Ohioans have been fighting about the lines for more than 200 years. To understand how the heck we got here, we have to go a little further back in time, to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in 1812. And a founding father, the University of West Georgia professor Tom Hunter, is pretty sure you've never heard of.
This is in the midst of what's called the first party system between the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans. And the Jeffersonian Republicans were in control of the state legislature, and they drew a districting scheme for the state Senate, unlike almost any districting scheme ever seen in American history. Wildly convoluted districts that split counties and split townships to give the Republicans a majority in the state Senate. And so a Boston newspaper ran a picture of a woodcut of some of the most egregious looking districts. And at a dinner party that some leading Bostonians were having, they were looking at these pictures that had just appeared in a Boston paper and laughing about them. And an artist, Elkanah Tisdale, took pen to paper and added a few things to one of the worst looking districts, added some wings and drew some claws and added a beak with teeth. And someone said, that will do for a salamander. And some other wit piped up and said, salamander, that's a gerrymander. Well, Massachusetts governor was Elbridge Gerry. And although he wasn't the author of the districting scheme, he was a proponent of it and signed the bill that became law. And so this woodcut with the additions to it that really, really made it look like a monster was then printed in a Boston newspaper. And underneath it said, the gerrymander or gerrymander. He called his name Gerry, Elbridge Gerry, but for some reason has been pronounced gerrymander.
I love it. The founding father we never heard of. He is one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, right?
Right. He went to the Constitutional Convention, but did not sign the Constitution, was a member of the Continental Congress, Confederation Congress, U.S. Congress, governor of Massachusetts, and for a year and a half was vice president under James Madison.
And we only remember him for the incorrect pronunciation of his last name combined with the word salamander. This wasn't the first time that somebody tried to draw lines for political gain, but it appears to be the most brazen. It was the most blatant attempt that had ever been done. Is that fair?
I would say that. So during the colonial era, there had been several examples of districting for partisan purposes. You had some in the after the 1790 census and 1800 census in a few states, but nothing nearly as egregious as what happened in Massachusetts.
And the thing of it is, it worked. Jeffersonian Republicans, they get 49% of the overall vote, but they win 29 of the 40 seats in the state Senate. So, I mean, the gerrymander worked.
It did, at least for this one election. Now, what is interesting about this is that some would consider this what's called a dummy mander, in that the margins were so small that if you had just a shift of several percentage points towards the other party, that instead of winning all of these districts narrowly, you could lose lots of districts. And this is what happened the following election. So in the election of 1812, the Jeffersonians won 29 seats and the Federalists only won 11. Yet the following year, What happened was that there was a shift by 3 or 4 points. And what happened was a Federalist controlled 29 of the 40 seats. And they completely redrew the districts and got rid of the gerrymander. And there are all these cartoons and in the paper showing kind of a skeletal, you know, monster now that was dead. And there was, you know, in one, he was in a coffin and talked about the dead gerrymander.
It was a nice sentiment, but the gerrymander was definitely not dead. The idea of splitting counties and carving up communities for political gain spread. And it reached a boiling point here in Ohio in 1842. Professor Hunter says Congress had just passed the Apportionment Act, a law that says you can't elect members of the U.S. House at large, meaning they can't come from anywhere within your borders. The Apportionment Act said representatives must come from different districts in your state.
The Democrats were in control in 1842, and so they were
They were the map makers. That's Frank Strigari. He's general counsel for the Ohio Senate Republicans, and he's a bit of a history buff like myself.
So they were getting ready and they were prepared to draw. And actually, they called a special session. And the Whigs were, and when they had seen it as it was going, they were very much against it. Back then, what you needed in order to pass legislation was a higher threshold of how many members you needed in attendance. And when it came down to time for, you know, the Senate to ultimately take action on the bill, the Whigs just decided the only route they had to go and the only bullet they had really left in their chamber was to say, you know what, we're just going to all resign from office. Now, when they resigned, they only resigned for the special session. So they didn't resign and they weren't gone.
I didn't know you could do that.
Well, apparently you could back then. I don't know if you could do it honestly now. By resigning, they prevented a quorum and the Senate couldn't pass anything. So they basically just walked out and they turned in their resignations. The sergeant at arms in the Senate was being tasked to go retrieve them. And it's still the same case now, because even if you look at the statutes and the revised code, like the sergeant at arms has authority to go get people.
Imagine if the cops could come after you for not going into work.
Sometimes I might want the cops to come get me so I don't have to go into work. But no, they went and got them. They retrieved some of them. But when they brought some of those individuals back, They were like, we have resigned. We can't do anything.
And so then we get this constitutional convention. We're like, all right, maybe the legislature, something has to change. So we're going to put the governor, we're going to put the auditor, we're going to put the secretary of state, we're going to put other people in charge. And then that eventually falls apart in the 1870s, 1880s.
It does. But let me talk a little bit more about the 1840s, because there was another instance when the same thing happened. In 1848, the Whigs were in control. This is a context to what led to, what truly led to the 1851 convention. In 1848, the Whigs were in control. The Senate had passed their apportionment bill. The House had, they amended it a little bit. So this is getting into procedural, which I know you'll appreciate, but probably most people don't understand. But the Senate had passed it, made some quick tweaks. The Senate did not concur initially in their amendments, so they were at a stalemate. Well, when the Democrats at that time were in the minority, they didn't want to see that bill passed. So they walked out. They didn't resign, but they walked out. They left. So the Senate didn't have a quorum to do anything. So they were just constantly adjourning session from a day-to-day basis, and the Democrats had stayed back. Now, there was negotiations that were going on during that time, but what happened was the House, again, I'm going to use legislative technical terms, the House receded from their amendments.
This was illegal.
I don't think it went to court, but this is an interesting legal question. The House receded from their amendments, and the Senate Speaker at that time just declared it was law, and they signed it, and they signed both their names on the piece of paper, and they put it into effect, which procedurally
wise— I didn't know you could do—
I'm not sure you could do that, because the right House wasn't in control of the bill, in the process. And they just said, that's it. We're done. We're signing the law. So then it led to elections later that year for the General Assembly. And then the whole fight was this is interesting, just because knowing how we think about issues these days, the whole fight on that whole bill was whether Hamilton County should be split into two Senate districts. That was it. That was it.
And we've been fighting about Hamilton County and who gets to represent it ever since.
Hamilton County is the center of it for some reason for many, many times. But that was the whole fight was about whether or not you can split a county like Hamilton County, okay? Because Hamilton County, Cincinnati was sort of the place back, you know, at that time.
Also,
period.
Nowadays, though, it's just like a given that we have to because of population.
Yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. That's the bigger issue.
Yeah.
But so they had elections. Then they came back for the next General Assembly at the beginning of the next General Assembly, and the Democrats were taking the position that they won all of the respective seats in Hamilton County based upon a certificate that the clerk gave back in Hamilton County at that time, while the Whigs were saying, no, our person won. And they were both trying to out-yell each other about trying to organize the General Assembly for that new General Assembly. Now, I'm not going to get into what ultimately happened, but like, you know.
Hold up. So yeah. I'm going to stop you right there.
Yes.
So you had the two candidates for the election both show up and say, I'm the representative.
Yeah. Now, as you probably will know, the General Assembly is technically the final arbiter of membership in their respective bodies to this very day. If there's an election contest about who's the rightful person who got elected, the body will decide that question. So it was ultimately coming down to that. And what happened was, I think there was that the Free Soilers, who were a sort of a third party group at the time, I think wound up ultimately brokering a deal with the Democrats to give them control, and then they were able to bring in the members that they needed to bring in. But like, again, I can just picture this, you know, having worked in the place, is that you have on one side of the chamber, you have a group of people who are acting like they're doing things and they're leading it. And then you have another guy on the other side. Simultaneously, on the other side, you have the other party trying to do the exact same thing. And they were literally trying to out-yell each other. That was sort of the point when I think everyone sort of realized, okay, we got to do something, okay, to change what's going on and just this whole redistricting fight, because that whole fight that led to who was in charge was all rooted in how the map was drawn.
Frank says this is where we get to the Constitutional Convention of 1851, where we remove the General Assembly's power to redistrict state legislatures. We give it to the governor, the Secretary of State, and the state auditor. And this is supposed to fix things. But by the 1780s, it had pretty much fell apart. Between 1878 and 1886, five consecutive congressional elections proceeded under different district lines, which means we were redrawing our maps every other year. A different party would gain control and draw a new map, because the law in the United States doesn't prohibit drawing maps in between censuses. In fact, at this stage of the game, it didn't even require that you drew new maps at each and every census. That rule comes later on. Here's University of West Georgia professor Tom Hunter again.
After the one-man, one-vote decisions in the 1960s, states do have to do it at least after every census. Before that, you had a number of states, if their numbers did not change, would keep the same districts for 20, 30, and in one case, Louisiana, kept the same districts for 50 years just because their number of members of the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, did not change at all. And so they just kept the same districts.
Oh, they didn't reapportion. That's wild.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which was one of the reasons why you would get the one-man, one-vote decisions stemming after Baker versus Carr, so Westbury versus Sanders and Reynolds versus Sims in 1964, because you were getting these huge disparities in population because of significant urbanization. And with districting schemes staying the same, but urbanization, these urban districts were getting much, much, much larger than rural districts. And there was nothing up to this point saying that the districts had to be equally populated.
It's crazy to me that it took until the 60s for us to be like, you know, there should be about the same number of people in each district.
That was one way to gerrymander, was to pack as many of your opponents into one really overly populated district. Now, a lot of states tried to make their districts fairly equally populated, but there were some noted examples. The most egregious as far as Congress goes, that the Chicago district was 17 times as large as one of the downstate districts in Illinois. So basically, if you lived in this very small rural district, you had 17 times as much voting power to elect someone to the House of Representatives as if you lived in Chicago. And for the state legislatures, it was even worse than that.
States were allowed to divvy up their districts by county. For example, that would mean Franklin County, with its 1 million people, would get a single representative in the state house. But so would Vinton County, which has a population of 13,000. This kind of county-by-county representation was a way of packing urban voters, voters who tended to be both Black and Democratic, into as few districts as possible. And it was banned by the U.S. government, along with racial gerrymandering. But political gerrymandering? That's another story.
The U.S. Supreme Court in the 1980s suggested that if partisan gerrymandering got too bad, was too extreme, that it could rise to a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And there are various cases that were brought thereafter until finally in 2019 in Rucho versus Common Cause, the U.S. Supreme Court 5-4 wrote that this was a non-justiciable political question and couldn't be decided by the court.
Non-justiciable is just a fancy way of saying it's not for us to decide, right?
Right, right. So they said there's no way to determine how much is too much. And courts don't decide, you can't decide this without using some sort of non-judicial discretion, that we would be doing things that courts would not usually be doing. So this is something best left to the people's representatives and not the court system.
It's not different necessarily from the earlier decision, because I'd read about this. I think it was Kennedy was the swing vote who agreed with the majority, but had said in this separate concurring opinion, hey, if it gets really extreme, if there is a clear way of determining gerrymandering and determining that it was done for political gain, he was basically saying, like, if you could meet this criteria, I would consider voting for political gerrymandering. But by the time the case gets back to the court, the political makeup of the court has changed.
It is interesting that Rucho's decided in 2019, just the year after Kavanaugh had replaced Kennedy on the court.
So the case got there just a little too late for Kennedy.
If Kennedy had really been concerned with it, there were plenty of cases the court could have taken before this point. But I think they were always kind of wary on the topic, and is something that they would rather not deal with. And the court just said, you know, this is not for us. This is something that the elected representatives should deal with. Or you can deal with it through state laws. If a state Supreme Court wants to say under the state constitution, it's illegal, you can do that. But federal law is something we're not going to touch.
Which brings us to Ohio 2008. Democrats had a majority on the apportionment board. That's what it was called back then. And Republicans, like then Speaker of the House John Husted, we're talking about redistricting reform, along with League of Women Voters President Jen Miller.
Our first ballot initiative to end gerrymandering in Ohio was in 1981, and the Ohio Republican Party endorsed it, and the Democrats opposed. Why? Because the Democrats were the map drawers.
Democrats didn't take the olive branch in 2008. They thought they were going to win the 2010 election. They thought they were going to be in charge of redistricting. They were wrong. Republicans pummeled their opponents in midterm races across the country. John Kasich became governor of Ohio, and Representative John Boehner became Speaker of the U.S. House.
And let's talk about the 2010 mapping process, because where we are today, the 2010 process is definitely something we should know about.
Coming up, what happens when Republicans take control of the map-making? That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Redistricting is a subject that might have put you to sleep in middle school, but it's one of the most important building blocks of our democracy. It's how we choose the people who will represent us. It's how representative democracy works. And when it's done unfairly, when the maps are manipulated for political gain, it skews representation, dilutes our voices, undermines trust in our democratic system. We've been walking through the history of gerrymandering this hour, and we've arrived at the Redistricting Majority Project, otherwise known as Project Red Map. The idea came from the Republican State Leadership Committee, run by a guy named Chris Jankowski. Here he is talking with Rachel Maddow of MSNBC in March of 2015.
What we thought was set it up in 2012 to take U.S. Congress. But by the summer of 2010, we realized, well, we're going to get the House.
This year, yeah.
So what we're going to do is lock that in.
For a decade.
Well, I will say there's a shelf life to these lines.
Okay.
And we don't know how long they are. But eventually, they do wear off.
Right.
So political environment trends can overcome that.
Big enough waves, big yes. enough years can
demographic
overcome
growth.
Even this sort of stuff.
Sure.
But you do change the structure of the field on which politics is played.
I'd rather be us than them.
Yes, got it. So when you went to national donors about this plan, saying we can leverage your national money to do something that you can't quite imagine with it, did you actually spell out for national donors the whole plan and the way it would work? Or did you just go to donors with whom you had the kind of relationship where you could say, trust us, we have a plan, you don't want to know the nitty gritty, but your money will be well spent?
Well, those donors don't exist anymore in the Republican Party. They ask questions. They ask questions then. We had a chairman, Ed Gillespie, mm-hmm. who was an established national figure, and he convened the donor pitches. And yes, I walked through our targets. I explained how we were going to do it. I explained how we were going to take the first 5 to 10 million and what states those would go into, and that was the Great Lakes states, and then where the next 5 million would go and the next 5 million. And we ended up bringing in about 20 million. In about 90 days, and amazingly get it out, getting it back out the door. In the Ohio House, we had 10 different targets that we narrowed down to 6. So we had 10 different mail plans, cable ads, polling, and every other state we did that. We targeted primarily 12 to 15 states that would have the most impact on congressional redistricting, and we got the money spent.
This wasn't a project Republicans hid at the time, and then we only learned about years later. Karl Rove published an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010. The headline read, GOP targets state legislatures. And the plan laid out beneath was essentially what Chris had told Maddow in 2015. Win majorities in legislatures across the country and draw districts that will benefit Republicans for the next decade. But it was Rove's subtitle that caught my attention. That smaller headline just above his byline. The subtitle read, "He who controls redistricting can control Congress." Here in Ohio in 2011, Republicans were in control. Here's Ohio Public Radio State House reporter Joe Ingles.
In 2011, it was completely different than it was in later years. That was before voters passed the redistricting plans in 2015, again in 2018. Back in 2011, I remember camping out a lot at the Doubletree, which was where the key players in that redistricting battle, that's where they kind of, you know, it was the bunker. That's where they all hung out. And things were being done, a lot of them were being done behind closed doors.
Yeah, so they had a hotel room at the
right.
Doubletree, downtown Columbus,
mm-hmm.
and it's where the Republicans, because they were the ones in charge.
Right, the Republicans were in charge, and they were going to the Doubletree, and they would meet behind closed doors in private, and then they would kind of come out with a plan. No one, you know, really was involved in watching the process from the outside, and they on the inside, it was the people who were involved with it that drew the maps. But it was very tight, and you couldn't get in there, and you were relying a lot on what you were being told at that time.
The bunker is quite the name for a set of rooms at a hotel in downtown Columbus. It's the kind of nickname that can sound pretty partisan, which is why I want to be clear about something. Democrats didn't name those rooms at the Doubletree the bunker. And neither did the media.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting things is that it's not like the people who were against gerrymandering called it the bunker. They called it the bunker themselves. That's sort of an admission that, yeah, they were doing something offline, not at the State House, not public. They went rogue and brought it into a hotel.
That's former Democratic Party chair David Pepper. He's written a book about gerrymandering, Laboratories of Autocracy. And one of the chapters in the book focuses on 2011 and all the documentation that came out when the ACLU and the League of Women Voters sued for it.
They took public staff from the State House, temporarily laid them off from the State House to then be rehired as private contractors. So everything was kept a secret. And, you know, they just kind of rotated into that room for a long time to draw maps in secret. And you know, the next 10 years of Ohio politics were essentially predetermined in that bunker. And they did their best to keep it all, you know, private. Obviously, the later lawsuit brought a lot of this stuff out. I give great credit to the League of Women Voters for getting all this information out. But it was about as grotesque a process as you could ever see. And I do think the fact that they themselves called it the bunker tells you everything.
Some of the email exchanges are pretty surprising. You see them between then it was U.S. Speaker of the House John Boehner from Ohio having conversations with these map makers, essentially saying, hey, this person wants to be in this district. Can you go ahead and move this line? And then you see a reply email a few minutes or like an hour later saying, yeah, sure. And there was this very clear back and forth. And you might just say that's benign in some ways, but there was a real line of communication between the Speaker of the U.S. House and the men in the bunker.
Yeah, actually, I don't think it's benign. I think it actually shows how broken it was. I mean, this is supposed to be the system of drawing the democracy of your state and drawing a real democracy. And some of the emails that came very, very late in the process. I mean, after all the, even they had had, I think, some of the public meetings, which were kind of a sham, but they had them. And at the very 11th hour, there was one email that said, hey, could you take a little bit of this district and move a little bit over there? And this was to actually put the Timken headquarters into a different district. And the shocking thing about it wasn't that it was so late in the game, but after all this process, the reply saying, yes, we'll do it, came, as you said, within maybe minutes or a couple hours. So when it comes to sort of the public part, it's, you know, you don't see a lot of representation. But when a private player, and I don't know if even anyone permanently even lived in this section, when they wanted a district to include them, up to John Boehner and his staff, they agreed in a heartbeat. And it just shows you just how upside down that was. The other one that I enjoyed then was one state senator wrote to the committee in the bunker, hey, could you not split Clark County, which is where Springfield is? And the email chain that followed was that this was crazy that this one state senator didn't want his county split in half because that would deprive them of another Republican district they wanted. So they're literally just absolutely, you know, focused on the partisan side of it. And someone in good faith saying, can we keep my county whole, is treated like it was the most insane idea ever that they actually want to do that.
Pepper's a Democrat. But the documentation he's referencing was part of the discovery process from that lawsuit by the ACLU. You can read the emails online for yourself. Like this one from former Ohio Senate President Tom Niehaus in September of 2011. He's telling Republican mapmakers that he's, quote, committed to ending up with a map that Speaker Boehner fully supports. The League of Women Voters was a party in that lawsuit as well. Here's their president, Jen Miller.
In the bunker, they had names for voters that were really not nice. So parts of Central Ohio and urban Columbus area, they called the voters the dog meat voting territory. Those were voters that they expected to vote more progressively. Because remember, this was they were trying to make these were conversations with in emails with Team Boehner that words like dog meat voting territory in the Franklin County sinkhole were used. The Franklin County sinkhole was Joyce Beatty's district where they were trying to sink as many progressive voters as possible into that district so that the other two congressional districts that were representing Central Ohio would go Republican. Here's the reality on that. Central Ohio should never have had last decade two Republican seats, one Democrat seat. And for me, this isn't about party. For me, this is about are voter preferences matching with the way the maps are behaving?
Miller says you can look at the election results from 2012 through 2020. Ohio had 16 seats in Congress, and 12 stayed Republican, while 4 remained Democrat, no matter what was happening in the country. In 2012, when President Obama won Ohio, Republicans won 75% of the congressional seats here. In 2016, when Ohio went for Donald Trump, the GOP still won 75% of the congressional seats.
For me, it's not about how many seats each party got. What it shows me is that this is a map insulated from voter opinion. It means that even when there's a wave one direction or another, there's no change in legislative seats. That should worry us, because what that means is they have been rigged. They have been predetermined for certain outcomes.
I want you to keep in mind that none of this is illegal. The U.S. Supreme Court has essentially said as much. And as Professor Tom Hunter pointed out earlier, political gerrymandering isn't prohibited by federal law. It's different than racial gerrymandering. And at this point in our story, in 2011, Ohio hasn't passed that last set of constitutional amendments. And you should also keep in mind that it's not like Democrats had no say whatsoever in drafting those 2011 maps.
The Snake on the Lake, which was a congressional district, a General Assembly district, which was brought to me back in 2011 by the Democrats.
That's Republican Senate President Matt Huffman.
They wanted to make sure that Marcy Kaptur would not get beat by Dennis Kucinich. So they said, draw this district, not that district, and we will then vote for it. And you won't need, and we'll vote for your emergency clause to put it in place. You can ask Chris Redfern or any other Democrat who was on the floor at the time. And that's, in fact, what we did at the request of the Democrats.
Which leads us to the redistricting reform amendments of 2015 and 2018, two overwhelmingly popular constitutional amendments that changed how we drew legislative maps for the state House and state Senate and our congressional maps for federal government.
Yeah, so 2011, I was the majority leader in the House, and Speaker Batchelder asked me to be the point man. Now, ultimately, the Speaker's in charge, but I was very involved in that process, both the congressional and the General Assembly part of it. And it was all when it was all done.
5 years later.
Well, no. We had maps in 2011. Mm. There was a redistricting proposal in 2012. Which said, well, we don't like these maps. We want to change it. It had a version of the proportionality that's in this bill, but less onerous. And the voters defeated that. And I decided in the next General Assembly, 2013 and 14, that maybe we could come up with a bipartisan system. And so I drafted resolution, actually one for congressional, one for GA in 2013 and 14. And we passed that bipartisan base. I think there was one no vote in the Senate, which he likes to remind me of occasionally. and we passed that, and we took that to the voters. I was not in the General Assembly in 2015 and 16, and I was one of the co-chairmen for the statewide campaign, along with Representative Sykes, who was also not in the General Assembly, but now joined me in the Senate later. So we went throughout the state. We campaigned. Both parties supported it. League of Women Voters passed 75%-ish. And then the same thing happened in 2018. I drafted that proposal. We got it worked out on Super Bowl Sunday, I remember, with Kenny Yuko and Vern Sykes and President Obhoff and myself. And that went on. We all supported it. We passed it.
And for a moment, there's this feeling of optimism, this sense that, to borrow a line from Arnold Schwarzenegger, that Ohio might have terminated gerrymandering once and for all.
We are at a tipping point. Voters around the country are more and more rejecting the 200-year-old scam of politicians drawing their own district lines. In boxing terms, gerrymandering is up against the ropes. In movie terms, they're dying at the box office. And I have to throw in also the bodybuilding terms, of course. They're losing their pump. We have pushed this weight up the mountain, and we have reached the top. And we can finally see the possibilities ahead of us. We have mainstreamed the wonky technical subject of district reform and of district lines. Redistricting is finally sexy and hip. And I know this firsthand because the people today don't just come up to me anymore and talk about bodybuilding or about fitness and movies. They come up to me and they say, congratulations that you're involved in redistricting reform. And I love that you're trying to say hasta la vista to gerrymandering.
So what happens when Ohio's newly minted redistricting commission draws its first set of maps? That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We've been working our way through redistricting this hour, and we've finally made it to 2021, the year Ohio tried to draw maps with its new constitutional rules. Jen Miller from the League of Women Voters was cautiously optimistic.
Good government groups had a lot of hope because it was the first time in our history that both Republicans and Democrats agreed on this plan. But we also saw that there were some flaws in the plan. Our serious hope was that because it was the 2015 and 2018 standards were these grand works of compromise, that same spirit would remain in the mapping process.
Ohio's Redistricting Commission has three state officials, the governor, the secretary of state, and the auditor. And it has four legislative leaders, two from the Senate and two from the House. Since Republicans hold all those statewide seats, they ended up with five votes on the Redistricting Commission, and Democrats had two.
We remained hopeful, but we had concerns right out the gate. We were asking the Ohio Redistricting Commission to start early. The census data was going to be delayed because of COVID. But there's so many other things that we could do. We could have been deciding how we were going to implement or interpret certain parts of those amendments. We could have been talking about the fact that the public were supposed to be able to submit maps and how were we going to enable that. There was all these reasons to have hearings. And we first started asking for hearings in January of 2021. And they continued to say that there was nothing to do because we didn't have the population data. That by itself was already concerning. And then finally, they decided they were going to do hearings around the state, but they gave us like 2 days notice to go all around the state, two a day. So we did 10 cities in 1 week. They were all during the day, often with bad parking. There were no maps. There was no districts to even comment on. And they put them in all these little tiny locations. I think they assumed no one would show up and they were just trying to follow the Constitution. Like, well, you said we're supposed to have hearings. We had hearings. Despite that, we filled every hearing room. They had to open overflow rooms. They had to get a larger room in Toledo, and it was still standing room only. One of the locations, the testimony went so long that the next location had to start late. And they were just continually coming out and begging for fairness, asking this commission to not gerrymander, to not put their self-interest first as politicians. They didn't have maps to comment on, but we had thousands of people show up.
That's not how Senate President Matt Huffman remembers it. He says the timeline was rushed because COVID delayed the census, which delayed the data, which delayed the map making, which left the commission with little time to pass a set of maps by the constitutional deadline. A deadline they missed by 2 minutes. Republicans approved a set of maps for the Ohio House and Senate on September 16th at 12:02 a.m.
The question is, well, who gets to decide what gerrymandering is? Well, we know what Richmond was doing to Charleston in 1860 was bad. We know drawing a circle around a house so that guy can be in a member of parliament is bad. So how do we mitigate the unfairness? Because
was the snake on the lake bad?
Was the snake on the lake bad? In context of resolving that at the moment, no. But it also was one of those things that said, we don't want to do that anymore. And the way to do that is don't let people make that compromise anymore. So our 2018 reform, which is still in the Constitution, has a whole lot of things in it that prevent the snake in the lake from can't happen anymore. And so what is, I think, the fairest, and I love the rule word fair because everybody throws it out and says, fair is what I want. But I think what is fair is establish a set of rules so everybody knows what the rules are and play that way. And that's what we did in 2015. We don't want to have split up cities and counties. We got rid of the 10% requirement for populations, and that was in some situations. We got rid of a lot of things in the congressional so that we couldn't have the snake on the lake. Remember, largely, there were no rules prior to 2015 and 18, except federal law. So it's essentially restricted the majority's ability to do whatever it wanted. And that was my resolution in 2015. You think they'll put that on the TV commercials?
I don't know that it would fit in a 30-second spot.
That's one of my problems, I guess. So I think that the 2015 and 18 reforms, again, widely supported, were anti-gerrymandering reforms.
The Ohio Supreme Court disagreed with how Huffman and the other Republicans on the commission interpreted those reforms. In January of 2022, they declared our state house maps unconstitutionally gerrymandered.
And they waited 4 months, a week or 10 days before the filing deadline, said draw a map like this. Well, in one sense, we're sort of like, well, if they're throwing out what we're supposed to do, because we had actually combined two sets of incumbent senators together. And we thought we had to do that to comply or to at least get approval from the Supreme Court. And by the way, those four incumbent senators were not happy with Senate President Matt Huffman at the moment. One thing we, of course, looked at was what was in the Supreme Court's opinion. None of that was in the Constitution. So we, I think, collectively said, well, let's do the best we can.
This is where House Minority Leader Allison Russo enters our story.
The day that my caucus held the vote to elect me as Minority Leader was the exact same day that the very first decision came down from the Ohio Supreme Court throwing out those first rounds.
Oh, so you got blown away by the news cycle.
Correct. Well, that had happened earlier in the day, and then I was voted in that evening. So, and then the next day, I think the next decision came down because there were separate decisions for the legislative, state legislative, and congressional. So it was no time to breathe, hit the ground running. This would be what would consume, you know, the first 5 to 6 months of my leadership was being on this redistricting commission.
So you get on the commission, and they've been told to try again by the Supreme Court. Did you think maybe that it was going to work?
Yes, of course I did. You know, I think there was immense relief and excitement that, hey, you know, this court, which was a split court, we had a swing vote in the Chief Justice that, you know, they were very clear in their decision that these maps did not follow the intent of the Constitution. They needed to be redrawn. I think the normal expectation is that the members of the commission, all members of the commission, would act in good faith. They would follow the rule of law. They would follow the Ohio Supreme Court. So, you know, I went into that initial round of redraws with a lot of optimism. And I think the perspective that, okay, now everyone is going to be forced to sit down, you know, at the table. It probably won't be perfect, but, you know, we will all come as honest negotiators. And, you know, I look back now and laugh at how naive I was.
The Supreme Court invalidates a second set of maps on February 7th and gives the commission 10 days to draw a new set. But they don't. The Ohio Redistricting Commission adjourns before the court deadline, and Matt Huffman tells reporters he doesn't think it's possible to follow the Constitution and follow the court's order.
But ultimately, the Supreme Court was trying to draw the map by instructing us how to draw the map. The Constitution specifically says the Supreme Court shall not draw a district or a map. What the least four members are trying to do is, well, we know we can't do it, but we can make them, we're going to hold their hand and move the pencil around the way we want. And ultimately, there was not a majority of members of the commission who were willing to do that.
It's a standoff between Republicans on the Redistricting Commission and the majority of the Ohio Supreme Court. As a state house reporter at the time, I can tell you it was a strange moment. We were sitting there as a press corps, wondering if the court was going to hold the Senate president, the governor, in contempt.
I remember the same feelings and wondering what was going to happen. And I had a hard time, as someone who covers government, I had a hard time understanding how government officials could say, yeah, we're not going to do what the court told us to do.
And then ultimately the court was like, hey, why don't you come and explain what problems you're having? And they produced another map.
Yes.
So crisis averted.
Yes, yes. But, you know, it was one of those situations where the people who were watching it closely were appalled.
I wanted to know what the Ohio Supreme Court would have done in this moment if the commission had missed another deadline. So I asked former Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor.
They could have let the court know that they needed another day, but instead, what did they do? They whipped out a map that had been maybe in the president of the Senate's back pocket, and I say that facetiously, and said, here's the map we're going to use.
They had
no intention of not using that map, I believe.
What happened next was also pretty strange. The commission hired independent mapmakers, one Republican, one Democrat. They put them in a room with cameras and let all of us, the whole state of Ohio, watch these guys draw districts.
The reason we did that is because the Supreme Court ordered us to do that. And we're scratching our heads saying, okay, we'll go ahead and do that. The reason we didn't use their maps is they didn't comply with the Constitution. In fact, one of the map makers, the one hired by the Democratic side, left early because he had run out of time, had something else to go. And so the Republican, sort of the guy hired by the Republican side, because each of the two parties got to hire their map maker, he was still around. But as we looked at the map and we had this specific time frame that the court ordered, you shall do it by this time, we got to the end of that time and there was no map and we only had one map maker left.
I think where I really just completely knew beyond a reasonable doubt that this process was broken was the point where we got the independent map drawers in. They drew the map, and then the rug was pulled out from under them at the last minute, and a new map was substituted, and they went forward and passed illegal maps again. At that point, I said, this is broken beyond repair. This process will never work.
In a way, Russo was right. A federal court had to step in and implement a set of maps. They basically said, Ohio, you've run out of time. The election is coming, and this set of unconstitutional maps is going to have to do. The commissioners do come back in 2023 and pass another set of maps, and they do it unanimously.
Ultimately, when the system was allowed to work in 23, what we anticipated by the 2015 reform, in fact, happened. There was a series of incentives and penalties, give and take, and a map was passed on a bipartisan, unanimous basis in 2023. And I challenge your listeners and listeners everywhere to find such a bipartisan, unanimous support on such a contentious political issue.
Russo says that's a misleading way of framing what happened in 2023.
Our vote, and I've said this from the beginning, I said it during the commission, I wrote about it, spoke about it extensively, was not because I believe that those maps are in any way fair or that they reflect the will of the people. That vote was simply to remove the pen from this commission and not allow them to redraw them again in 2 years. Because at that point, we did not know if the citizen-led commission would be qualified for the ballot yet. And we would again be subject to another round of redistricting that could put us in a position to have even worse maps than what we have now.
Russo and the former Chief Justice are now working to pass another constitutional amendment this November, one that would take politicians out of the process and give it to a citizen commission made up of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. We're going to help you understand Issue 1 in the coming weeks, untangle how we draw fair maps, how commissions in Arizona, Michigan, and Iowa work, and why gerrymandering is so bad anyway. That's all coming up on this season of Untangled. Tune in next Monday, only on 89.7 NPR News.